Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marcus Hippi.
On the show today, Selling, the musical duo formed by electronic beatmakers Gold Panda and Jazz Shaw of Simian Mobile Disco. They will be here to talk through their recent record On Reflection.
We'll also be hearing from documentary filmmakers Betsy West and Julie Cohen about their film RBG, which profiles the life of US Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And we'll be hearing from Pedro Correa do Lago, whose new book, The Magic of Handwriting, looks at the power of the written word.
That's all coming up. Plus, another Brazilian, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, will be looking ahead to next week's news and will enjoy plenty of great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So, hello, Tom. It's good to be in the studio with you again. As you pointed out already, there's a fair bit of Brazilian flavour in the air today.
Absolutely. A samba sachet through the Monocle Weekly. But we should point out, there's also a fair bit of general festive fun. Let's unwrap the present that everyone wants for Christmas. Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
There was something.
And Fernando is jolly as ever. What's your Christmas plan?
Merry Christmas. It's quite similar to yours, Marcus, in a way, except without the sauna, in a way. But in Brazil, yeah, Christmas Eve is the main day. It's like, I would say Christmas Eve is disco and Christmas Day is bossa nova in Brazil.
How much do you wear? I would imagine everyone being like there on their bikinis and you in your tiny shorts.
Well, it depends on the family, but actually it's quite casual, actually. But we're not like the Brits, so for example, we don't like, you know...
Christmas jumper?
No Christmas jumper, for sure. Perhaps a sunga, you know, with a Christmassy kind of vibe there.
What do you eat?
Well, my family is actually, I think a lot of Brazilians eat turkey, but we eat beef and steak. I mean, I know there are some kind of... So vegetarians in my family, and sometimes they might have fish or other things as well.
But Fernando, you're actually here to go through the interesting news events in the upcoming 7 days.
Exactly, it's not quite Christmas time yet.
What do you have on your schedule?
Well, my first story is actually quite Christmassy, and it's one of the wonderful traditions of the UK. One of the reasons I moved here, the official Christmas number one will be released here in the UK. And let's be honest, I think the UK is the only country that actually gives so much attention to the Christmas number one. I mean, of course, the US, they have like their holiday chart, but it's not the same influence. And people are waiting anxiously. I mean, are you curious to see who are the contenders, perhaps?
I'm definitely curious. Do you have some thoughts about who it might be? It's not Baby Shark, though, is it, Fernando?
It's not
Baby
Shark.
We've been talking about that a lot this week.
I wish it would be Baby Shark, because I think it's an excellent Christmas song made by the Koreans with an excellent electro beat in the underground. And they say Baby Shark, Mummy Shark, whatever shark. It's a great song.
But that's not going to trouble the top spot.
Not going to trouble. I think it would be Ariana Grande with Thank You Next, which is already actually number one, but people are predicting such a massive hit. I would imagine you like that song, Marcus.
It would be nice to have something more Christmassy for Christmas,
well,
no?
In the video clip, she does kind of, she wears like a Mama Claus. How do you say the female version of
Mrs.
Santa
Claus?
Mrs. Claus.
She's got a Mrs. Claus kind of outfit vibe.
Kind of. So you know what I mean? There are some vibes there. But also some people are saying that perhaps Elton John with your song, which is in the John Lewis Christmas ad. An old favorite. It's a great song as well. And Mark Ronson and Miley Cyrus as well with Nothing Breaks Like a Heart.
What else is happening next week?
Well, Friday, it's something, you know, it's a very kind of light week in terms of serious news. But this is something that always makes me happy. It's the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere on Friday. So finally, we you know, the days will become longer. But of course, again, it's a big tradition here in the UK. You know, all the pagans, they go to Stonehenge and they do their thing there in the evening.
They do their thing. They certainly do.
Sorry, I don't know.
I have to say, the nights get shorter and shorter. And I can only imagine Marcus back in the motherland. When does it get dark? About lunchtime?
It really depends on where you are in Finland. Because obviously, if you go above the Arctic Circle, the sun doesn't rise at all. So that's the definition of the Arctic Circle.
Exactly,
so if you're from there, you'd get no direct
sunlight,
but
actually.
But in, say, Sillin Jordavi, for example?
3-4 hours. In Helsinki, it's about
it.
5.5. Yeah, so it's very, very dark over there. So when I first moved to the UK, I felt like I was getting some kind of like sun treatment all the time.
Oh, wow.
But that has faded
imagine
away,
that
I have to say.
Because, yeah, because I'm going to Brazil this Christmas, and of course, it would be the opposite. It would be kind of, you know, our summer.
But then it's nice as well, like when you're in Finland, the days actually get a lot longer, very fast. So it's a number of minutes every day, and you kind of realize, you feel the difference quite early on already.
So when's the actual shortest day? Is it next? It's Thursday, is it?
21st of December. So
okay. Oh, it's
Friday.
It's within sight.
It's within sight.
That's a real sort of turning point for me in the year. I love it when the nights, even it's only gradual, obviously, at the first, but as soon as they start going the right direction, that's great news, I think.
Well, Fernando, what else is happening?
Well, sorry to keep my stories quite Christmassy as well, but in a way, do you guys go to the cinema around Christmas? I mean, during the Christmas season, in a way.
I don't do that many cinema trips, Fernando, as you know, because I can't drag the screaming children in there with me.
Probably the last film I've seen was Titanic or something.
No, I went... I'm not that old! No, actually, I went to see Peter Rabbit.
Oh,
right. Not that long ago.
And I think your taste in films has changed. Or was it like that before?
No, that was pretty bad, I'll be honest. I was actually quite glad that I had to leave. But is there something that would make me break that recent habit and get back in the...
I have a tip for you and a tip for Marcus. I think you should go and watch Mary Poppins Returns. You know, it's a classic. I think, God, it's been more than... half a century, I mean, since the last film came out. But everybody's saying great things about Emily Blunt, saying that she might be nominated for an Oscar. The film might be nominated for the best film. I predict amazing box office numbers for that. But there's another fun, I think they will be released more or less at the same time.
And that's my recommendation.
This one is for Marcus. Mm-hmm. It's Aquaman. I mean,
what is that?
He's a superhero, and apparently is performed by Jason Momoa, as you can see. I know you like Men's Health, Marcus. He's on the cover of the January, February issue.
Oh, then I will like the film as well.
And he's got a lot of tattoos, and there's Nicole Kidman in it as well. And apparently there's some dolphin warriors as well.
So dolphin warriors.
Yeah,
Marcus,
so,
this sounds very Marcus.
This sounds really me.
You love a dolphin warrior, don't you?
Always, every now and then.
And I have a recommendation for myself.
don't eat your whole dolphin
good
warrior.
Dolphin
manga.
Warrior every now and then. All you need. Fernando, what's your own recommendation for yourself?
Tom, Mary Poppins, you, Aquaman, and the Dolphin Warriors, and I'll be watching a rom-com with J-Lo. I love rom-coms during Christmas.
What's this one?
Second Act, which, you know, she's just kind of poor her whole life, whatever, and then she became successful, and then, yeah, that's the kind of story.
That sounds pretty bad!
Great recommendations there. Thank you very much, Fernando. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. In a moment, we'll be talking music with Gold Panda and Jazz Shaw of Simian Mobile Disco. Stay tuned.
Jazz Shaw is one half of dance music and production duo Simian Mobile Disco, known for filling festival tents and clubs the world over. And Derwin Dickers, the similarly in-demand beatmaker Gold Panda. We last heard from the latter back in 2016, when he joined us to discuss his record Good Luck and Do Your Best.
But now the two of them have formed a new duo, Selling, and released the new album On Reflection, a concoction of rippling synths, pulsing bass, and smart tunes. And they join us in the studio to talk about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Shall we start with a bit of context first? I know you've known each other for about 10 years, but how did the idea of forming a collaboration happen?
It just happened really, really slowly. Incredibly slowly.
Yeah, over 10 years.
Yeah, over 10 years. Usually, like when you bump into people and you get on with them, it's always like Derwin says, like, oh, when we'll make a record, you know. And then we worked together on your records a couple of times. But yeah, you know, quite often because people are busy and, you know, it's difficult enough to organise your own life without organising somebody else's life.
Has there been any surprises regarding any work methods or anything you do in the studio?
I have puffy slippers.
That's true, yeah. My studio can get a bit chilly, so slippers, it's mandatory, right?
Yeah.
Come on. It's essential.
Well, apparently, a bit like the studio we're in now, a little chilly. Apparently, very good for brain function.
Okay, yeah.
So I don't know if you're maybe more creative.
Could be,
because you can get into a bit of a funk otherwise if it's a bit too.
That's a technique asleep. For the next one. We could get to a certain point if things aren't going well. We could just call slippers off. Be like, it's just not happening, is it? Come on.
Or you could do seasonality and you could have the ambience be of the... So that, when were you recording this? Because sort of over the summer or...
Really in dribs and drabs, over ages, yeah.
Okay, so my seasonal ideas. Let's park that one.
No, we could do that. I like that idea.
The new Four Seasons.
The new Four Seasons,
Come on, make it happen. So tell me a bit about the record then. I sense from what you're saying that you've sort of allowed it to all happen quite organically. Does that mean, therefore, that you didn't really have expectations for what the end product would be like? Or did you have did you both have something between you that you kind of knew you were trying to make almost?
I think when we started, we thought we should be making fast, hard techno. I think that's something we both enjoy, so we tried to make. And then as the process went on and we found an easy way of working, the tracks kind of fell together much more easily. And I think they had more of a song structure. It's just it's like trial and error, really. Just, you know, finding a natural way of working, I think. I don't know.
What is that way like? What is the natural way of working for you guys?
I think not overthinking stuff. I think when we were trying to think, oh, we should make this, then it didn't work. And as soon as we lost our inhibitions and lost a kind of plan, then it came together much more easily. So I think... Yeah, just does that make sense?
Yeah,
I'm just rambling on.
No, I know it sounds like a pretty comprehensive abdication of responsibility, and it wasn't that we just went in and went, I wonder what will happen. There is an element of that, but we sort of went in like Derwin says to like make some stuff. But I think the thing that like derailed it or sort of formed it into what it is that both of us were just really happy to just really be led.
Tell us more about your relationship with technology. I found that interesting. Do you feel like you need to keep on updating your studio all the time, for example, or do you sometimes just question all that?
The update that we most recently did was moving from sort of a 1970s setup to a kind of, I'd say...
Mid-80s, I hope, maybe?
I'd say late 80s, early 90s.
Oh, cutting
edge. I think the gear has... So whatever synth we choose has a role to play. There's a particular synth that we used on the record that is really difficult to program. Actually, it's not difficult, but it's just annoying. It's a late 80s synth and it has maybe 8 buttons to navigate a massive menu and lots of parameters for certain things. So it makes you want to give up. And I think just carrying on and trying to make it work is good, because when you get something that's good, you're kind of, you know, you're inspired to continue and a sense of achievement.
So what I was going to say, does it sound the better because you and other people will know the struggles? They'll kind of know the extra things you have to sort of twist and bend and get through to get there.
Yeah, in a way. And I think that it's to be surprised by what the equipment gives you back. You know, you give it some parameters and it gives you something you weren't expecting. Or what if you change something? What if you detune something, you know, by one semitone, or you make a sequence length kind of a little bit longer than, you know, a normal 4/4 beat or whatever. So yeah, those things throw up interesting results, I think. So it's also almost like having another member of the band, I suppose.
Well, and what about serendipity there? I mean, are there any stories on this record in particular of, you know, someone's kind of leaning on a thing and it changes in a way you hadn't foreseen, or little things where you did something and you were like, I don't even know why, but why don't we just? And then actually that's the thing that does it. Do you have those moments of...
Loads.
I don't know. Is that in itself fortune? I guess going back to the creative process. Is that fortune, or is that actually exactly the creative process you talked about?
I think the key to it is just saying when to stop. Right. So you can turn the dials and press the buttons. Anyone can do that. Like you can just set it randomly going.
You haven't seen me with technology. Honestly. There are some limitations, you know.
But it's like the key to it is knowing like when something magic is happening, you know. And like Derwin is really, really intuitive with that, where like sometimes you get something that's like, it's literally the first thing. You just switch everything on and it's doing it. It's like, okay, well, that, maybe there's something there. And he'll be like, that's great, let's just record that.
So did you sort of look to one another? Were there moments when you were like, that's it, unspoken?
Yeah. Actually, because we hadn't settled on this like synth that Derwin was on about until kind of later. And because I never used it up until then, it's right at the bottom of like a 19-inch rack. And so in order to program it for like the first bunch of sessions, before we'd sort of like attached to it, he had to lie on the floor.
On a beanbag?
On a beanbag, yeah, but it's quite a stress position.
Suffering for his art.
It was like, so I'd like look over and Derwin would be like sprawled out on the floor, kind of peering into this minuscule LCD display.
Derwin, what kind of situation was it for you, or an experience for you, considering your history as a solo artist, to actually work with a collaborator?
It was... Was I a bit of a diva?
Were you?
Demanding lunch.
I mean, as you can tell, it's like a nightmare on wheels.
It was, I mean, it was great, and I actually want to do more collaborations. I found that it's half the work, double the results, I think.
The maths I'm hearing, that stacks up.
Okay, that's good. That's positive.
It's good because a lot of the stuff that I find really difficult, like once we'd recorded our sessions and we had to do a lot of editing to make it into more of a song structure. I mean, maybe we didn't need to, but some of the tracks were 40 minutes long, so we had to edit them down. I think that it's good to have Jas around because he's really good at that. I don't know if he enjoys it. Do you enjoy that bit?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's particularly nice with having someone else who can, after a while, just go, stop chopping at that bit. Like, you know, you sort of like lose yourself in the detail after a while.
Yeah.
But definitely, like, I really like kind of like saving a copy of what we... Because also the way we record is you just kind of pretty ropily multi-track, like not even particularly, not all that much separation. And it means that you just like... You just listen through and like, rather than getting really fastidious, it's like, I'm just going to chop this 4 minutes out and delete it.
Yeah. I think I'm good at knowing what I think should happen and what will finish the track. But if it's me on my own, I can't be bothered to do it. So it goes from being a 40-minute jam sitting on my laptop for ages until I have the courage to look at that file again and chop through it. And I think it's good to have Jas there to do that. And he's very...
Angry.
Fueled by coffee, he gets it done.
Very angry.
Dare I ask you to try to mention something negative then about working with a collaborator as well? Is there anything? Can you think of anything?
Well, I've only collaborated with Jas and one other person, and they're both lovely, so there is no negatives at the moment.
100% ratio.
So yeah, 100%. So I haven't had any bad collaboration experiences, but I've never been in a band or anything, so it's great. It's great for me. But I don't know, Jas might feel differently.
I'll be honest, it can be difficult, right? I mean, things are almost always really easy with me and James and Simeon just because there's only two of us. And I think maybe because we've been through that process of having been in a band where you really do have to, you're managing a dynamic between four people, you know? And it's the other thing is, like, if you're properly in a band, chances are you'll be on the road for, like, 4 months solid and then you get back... And then you're like in a practice room with them, so you're pretty like you're in a room not much bigger than the room we're in now, which for the listeners listening at home is not very big.
It's cozy.
It's cozy. It's nice.
It's reasonably intimate. Well, what about then that sort? Because then some people say, oh, you know, well, do you sort of want, as you're making great music, do you not envisage it being performed or you guys being in venues making that music there, or does that process not? I know it's a different thing, but did you not think about that, or do you talk about that anyway?
We didn't talk about it, did it? Did
what,
we?
What, playing live?
Yeah, we did actually. We did talk about playing live. Yeah, the original plan was to play live, because I got unwell. We're not going to be able to tour it, or I'm not going to be able to go along. But the original plan was for us to make a bunch of things to give us an excuse to like tour around Europe together.
Yeah.
Which would be a laugh. Maybe one day we'll get to do it.
Yeah, we should.
That could be our big exclusive today.
Massive.
So that's going to happen.
And by the way, now I have to ask, by the way, what's the story behind the name of your act? What's the story behind Selling?
Is it a secret?
It's
I mean, there's a couple. I've got a fake story.
That's a
which
better,
is yeah. There's a tea plantation in India near where my grandmother grew up called Selling.
I think that's better than the
that's
true
pretty
story.
Good. Yeah, you're not bad with these truths, half truths, yeah. and a bit of mythology, especially right. naming mythology. If memory serves,
it comes from Aphex Twin, I suppose, isn't it? You make up a load of rubbish, yeah. so you can sell his old synthesizers. So yeah, that was always a fun bit of electronic music. I think all the nonsense that producers came up with. Or artists came up with to promote themselves was always, there's a bit of tongue in cheek involved. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, and maybe that's kind of brings us back to where we started, which is talking about you guys getting together, being friends of long standing to make the record. Is it a good reminder that actually, if you just have fun and make music with your friends, good things happen? I mean, trying to look for a sort of simple, not that your project has to have some kind of big moral core running through it, but that's a nice thing to take away, right?
Yeah. I think music doesn't have to be easy, you know. Like I do think that sometimes, like this record that we did together, it was pretty easy going. It sort of just came to us, but like honestly, it doesn't always work that way, and you just have to like roll with that. Like sometimes, it's pretty arduous, and it's like the fact that you're not going to give up is because
and it's not better one way that you know because some people say if you really suffer for your art. That imbues it with some kind of quality beyond.
I had to sit on that beanbag for like 4 hours.
Yeah, that was like a bit of suffering.
Yeah. So we're good on both sides, I think. I've got to say, I think that often people do make good art out of suffering, but I don't think that it's essential. Like, I think that sometimes, like music or art, can be very complicated or very, very like you know, incredibly well crafted. But I don't think that that's necessarily what makes it have an emotional response. Mm. Sometimes something very, very simple is at least as good as something that's like been really fastidiously and really like carefully put together. And I think like at the core of it, I tend to think that the intention behind it is as important as the sort of machinations of how it was made. Like, if it was made for fun or if it was made for cathartic reasons versus if it was like made... like just so you get DJ gigs. There's something really work-a-day.
I think you're outlining this sort of artisanal music production approach as opposed to.
I think there's music can be, you know, very political or academic, but there's also music that is just magical. Mm. There's a magical process that happens where something good just happens and you can't really, you know, explain why that's good. It's just it's happening now and you want to capture that magic, and I think that's just as valid as
how would you explain the intention behind the record of yours? Did you think about trying to achieve something? Have you been thinking about how successful you want it to be, or like what did you want to create?
Ironically, to sort of just cut myself down after what I just said, we just wanted to do gigs, didn't we? She's just blindly cynical.
I think just wanted to because we got on well when Jas mixed my first two records, and it was just to hang out more. And I think the music making was just something that we do together. Actually, when I first went to your house, we were just going to meet up and have a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And look at your studio.
Yeah.
And then we switched the gear on, and that was it. And that's how the collaboration really came about, because we did two really long tracks, and it was fun. And we thought we should just do it again. And that's really how it worked.
Well, I think it's a great story. I like it. Music through spontaneity, friendship, bit of serendipity in the mix as well. And as you said, that's when the magic happens.
Yeah.
Thank you both for coming to paint those pictures of the experience with us. Doan and Jas, the record is On Reflection and Selling Are They. Thank you both for coming to see us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marcus, should we have a tune from that very record?
Sounds good. Let's have a track that's called Keeping Time. Selling there with Keeping Time. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly, and we'll be hearing all about the documentary RBG after this.
To sit as a judge on the US Supreme Court, the council of eight legal experts who oversee some of the most influential and controversial proceedings in the United States, is a lifetime appointment. And for the past 25 years, one of those people overseeing law in the US has been Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the now 85-year-old justice who's been an advocate of gender equality and equal rights for her entire career.
Now a new documentary from filmmaking, news production and journalism duo Julie Cohen and Betsy West, RBG, named after the judge's initials, is hitting screens. The film looks at the pivotal role Ginsburg has played in US public life for over half a century and why she shows no signs of slowing down. Monocle's Augustine Larry spoke to Betsy West and Julie Cohen earlier, but first, here's a clip.
I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
We welcome today Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
She's become such an icon.
Would you mind signing this copy?
I am 84 years old, and everyone wants to take a picture with me.
Notorious RBG.
Yeah.
When you come right down to it, the closest thing to a superhero I know.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg changed the way the world is for American women.
My name is Betsy West, and I am one of the director producers of the documentary RBG.
And I'm Julie Cohen, and I'm the other director producer of RBG. We were aware, as most Americans are aware, of Justice Ginsburg's role on the U.S. Supreme Court for the past 25 years. She's the second woman to serve as a Supreme Court justice. And that's obviously important and quite a key legacy. But the more kind of amazing and lesser known story is what Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as a young lawyer, did to secure women's equal rights under the U.S. Constitution, starting in the 1970s, by taking a series of cases to make the argument that under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, women and men should be, and in her argument, in fact, must be, considered equals under the law.
As a law student, she excelled at Harvard. She graduated at the top of her class from Columbia Law School and then couldn't get a job. So she herself faced discrimination in the early 60s. And then in the early 70s, she began a project, the Women's Rights Project, in which she carefully selected a series of cases that would appeal to the nine male justices at the time sitting on the Supreme Court who really didn't think that, you know, such a thing as discrimination existed. They just thought that the laws that differentiated between the sexes were there to kind of help protect women. And what Ruth Bader Ginsburg did, sometimes by bringing lawsuits on behalf of male clients, she showed very strategically that these distinctions really are keeping women down.
Did you find, you know, when you were interviewing her, how did that kind of amazingly strategic mind sort of manifest?
Yes. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's amazing strategic mind is evident really in every sentence that she speaks. She's a soft-spoken woman. She tends, when she's asked a question, and we understand from her childhood friends, this has been true lifelong, she tends to pause for about 10 seconds and formulate an answer. Then when the answer comes, it's in a complete, it's almost like an essay. Every time she speaks, it's a well thought out beginning, middle, and end. She has one of the most organized minds and one of the best memories of anyone I've ever encountered.
Yeah, I mean, when we were interviewing her, she would remember names and dates of places of things that had happened, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
This sounds like a godsend to filmmakers.
Yes. Well, you know, sometimes she would get into the details that you didn't necessarily need, but she's got a quick wit, and she was such a fascinating person to profile. A very unusual documentary subject, but extremely rewarding.
This sudden extraordinary surge of popularity she's found among millennials. You know, she's become the subject of memes. There's this book, The Notorious RBG. She has this whole new nickname based on Biggie. What did that kind of popularity with young people say to you about the demographics of the contemporary United States?
Well, I think what it said to us is opportunity to make a film about this woman who has gained a lot of attention for the stinging dissents that she has been writing on behalf of civil rights, reproductive rights, you know, voting rights. And the millennial generation picked that up and branded her the notorious RBG, and there are memes and coffee cups, and people may not know that here, but some people have gotten tattoos with her picture on it, and you know, there's a Saturday Night Live impersonation. So for us, this was an opportunity to do a film, a window into her, to tell the full story that we were just talking about. The fact that as a young woman, she faced extraordinary discrimination, and she, in a very determined way, figured out a strategy that helped all American women. So, you know, it was an opportunity.
Among a fairly substantial portion of Americans, and I feel like it's even more important to say this when we're outside of America, among a fairly substantial proportion of Americans right now in the President Trump-led United States, there is a feeling that there should be a strong voice of dissent. And in fact, there's sort of a hunger for dissent. Justice Ginsburg, over the past few years, not necessarily in response to President Trump, but more relevantly in response to some of the decisions of a Supreme Court that has been moving to the right in recent years, has often become that voice of dissent. Because of her senior position in the court, she often has the opportunity, when she wants to write a kind of a counter opinion. You know, if the Supreme Court is saying, as in one example from 2013, we want to strike down some of the voting rights protections that have made sure that voter suppression is stopped in the South for African American and Hispanic voters. If the court wants to strike that down, Justice Ginsburg has written the dissenting opinion. It doesn't carry the day, but it strongly makes the case, wait a second, this is wrong, and it should be changed, and we should rethink this. And her dissents have really resonated, not just with the judge and lawyer community in the United States, but with the population as a whole, with the progressive population who themselves was feeling some wariness about some of the recent Supreme Court decisions. It felt good to hear that voice of dissent from Justice Ginsburg, so well put.
One of the things the film does really nicely is illustrate the way that the Supreme Court has shifted further to the right. You know, it takes the Supreme Court in 1993, I believe, when she was first nominated and appointed to it. And she's quite liberal. She's a very centrist figure.
Moderate. She's considered to be sort of moderate at
right.
that time.
Exactly. And then as people retire or pass away, Bush got to appoint two justices, and she has found herself at the left. I found that really striking. And I wondered what your reflections on that were, and on this kind of nominal impartisan court, which just in practice doesn't seem to operate that way anymore, or has it ever?
Well, the justices like to think of themselves as above politics, but in fact, there are ideological differences, especially on those hot button cases that come to the fore. And clearly, there's a liberal and a conservative side. In terms of her comments about then candidate Trump, which she made in the summer of 2016, she quickly retracted her criticism, because it really is the tradition that the Supreme Court stay away from politics. And she said that she, in retrospect, it would have been better had she said nothing.
Mm, indeed. And I suppose it is kind of, you know, as was then also followed up, people make mistakes, right? And this conception of the Supreme Court as people who are not people, but rather symbols.
Yeah. I mean, she's a voter. She gets to vote for whoever she wants to vote for. But making those comments, she acknowledged, was going a little too far. And since then, she has not repeated that.
I suppose I wondered if you felt that it kind of fed into the sort of partisanship that has really come to the fore now with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh earlier this year.
Well, you know, part of it has to do with sort of the public reaction to the remarks. I mean, certainly some progressives in the country who don't follow kind of the specific rules of the judiciary too closely think like, well, what's wrong with that? I kind of like what Justice Ginsburg said. A lot of Americans, in fact, agree with what she said. But the idea is that judges should be not weighing in personally so that their opinions come out through the rulings and the dissents that they write. There is a kind of everything in America right now is so polarized that it's hard for there not to feel like there's a partisan taint to everything that happens. Justice Ginsburg has been actually at the fore of saying that she thinks that partisan divides are a bad thing. And aside from that slip when she spoke publicly against then-candidate Trump, she's had a lifetime of bipartisanship, of, you know, her very close friendship with the quite famous, now deceased, conservative Justice Antonin Scalia, who was a close personal friend of hers, as we show in the film, her warm relationship with Senator Orrin Hatch, the Republican who, in his role in the judiciary, as the Republican leader of the Judiciary Committee when she was appointed, was a strong advocate for her. So the justices feel like to do their job best, it's good for them all to get along, despite where they might lie on the political spectrum.
Mm, and I suppose that's kind of part of that appeal that we were talking about with young people. This friendship with Scalia was something that I was going to raise because it was kind of touching in some ways. And it seems to represent a set of values that maybe, if, you know, I don't want to be pessimistic again, but if they're not lost, they're certainly slipping away.
You're strained. Let's put it that way. Yeah. I mean, listen, when we started this, some people would say to us, oh, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia, they're not really friends, are they? People didn't really want to believe it. But the fact is they were close friends. And it was a friendship based on respect. They both, and mutual interest, they both love opera. Antonin Scalia was a very funny man, and Justice Ginsburg loves to laugh. But I think, you know, more than that, they were intellectual equals, unafraid to have a verbal combat, to really engage with each other intellectually and seriously, with the idea that it helped sharpen each other's points. I mean, Justice Scalia famously shared one of his dissents to a majority opinion that Justice Ginsburg was writing. He shared it with her early so that she would have a chance to see what he was saying, and she, in fact, did change her opinion a little bit. So it's a very different perspective than everybody being in their corners. It's let's meet and let's at least respect each other enough to talk about this.
The dialectic, I suppose.
Yeah.
The kind of spiral that takes us onwards.
Yes, and that's a big part of the Supreme Court process. It really is quite different from the legislative branch, where often people are just sort of like yelling over each other. The Supreme Court, there are only 9 justices, and after they've read the briefs and heard oral arguments, they come together in a conference and really discuss the issues and try to sharpen and modify their own opinions in such a way that they can create a consensus, if at all possible. You know, the public hears less about this because the famous cases are the really hot button issues. But actually, there is consensus on most Supreme Court opinions, and that's even true still to this day. There are unanimous opinions are quite common. It's just that it's not on the headline issues. It's less common to get a unanimous opinion on, say, you know, a gay rights case or a voting rights case. But you know, there are a lot of other issues that the court is considering, and often they can find ways to agree.
And, you know, the other thing I'll say about Justice Ginsburg is she's smart, she's strategic, and you're not going to win people over to your side to perhaps vote for you unless you have a good relationship with them. And her attitude is that, you know, raising your voice, getting angry about something is really not going to get you where you want to go.
She definitely comes across as someone with an incredibly clear set of core values, which I guess, based on the footage you have of conversation with her friends, have really come down and been held onto closely from a very early age.
Yeah, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had the unusual situation not only of her mother passing away when she was only 17, but that followed an extended illness. Her mother actually knew she was going to die for a good bit of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's teenagehood and did the kind of remarkable and generous thing of using her final years to impart a very strong set of values down to her daughter, who was listening and absorbing. Everything that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is now is what her mother was teaching her to be during those final, her dying years.
Finally, I just wanted to ask a bit about, I mean, she has the most extraordinary work ethic. She works harder, I think, than any people I know of my age.
Yes. Yeah.
Really staggering. Works until 4 a.m. sometimes. Yeah. We see her working out in the gym doing, God knows what, 20 press-ups and all sorts.
Yes, we saw it.
She also talks about her unwillingness to stand down as long as she feels like she has the toolkit necessary to do her job as well as she can. And she clearly is still doing it very well. Did you get any vague feeling of regret from her that she maybe hadn't taken the opportunity to stand down and leave this space open for Obama?
You know, I don't know her inner thoughts, but certainly she showed no regret about that. She loves the law. She loves her job. She's really good at it. And you can see the determination she has to keep going. I mean, she 3 weeks ago, she fell and she broke 3 ribs. She was in the hospital one day, back at home working that weekend, and then she returned to the court the next day or the next week. So she is one determined person, and you know, I take it at face value that she feels this is a lifetime appointment. Many men who precede her have worked through their 80s, and one of her colleagues was 90 when he retired, and she sort of set that as a goal for herself.
Yeah, she's been talking about continuing to work at age 90 in recent months. I mean, that it's that hardcore determination which has been a hallmark of her style for her entire life that I think is part of what the appeal is of her in the public. You know, I mean, people have used the term sort of like badassery. I don't know if that's something that we're allowed to say on Monocle, but you know, she has that quality, and I think it continues to this day, and it's part of how she deals with the current situation of her being seen as a very needed voice of dissent. She knows that, she feels it, and she certainly is going to do her darndest to stay working.
Just very briefly and finally, what sense did you get from her about her response to her newfound position, not just as a kind of important judicial figure, but as a cultural icon?
Yeah, I mean, she gets the joke. She understands that it's kind of funny that an 85-year-old, she says, you know, I'm 80, in the film, she says, I'm 84 years old and everyone wants to take a picture with me. And that's true. She came with us to the Sundance Film Festival where RBG debuted, and she was a bigger rock star than any of the actors and other celebrities who were there. And I think she kind of gets a kick out of it. She actually carries one of the little tote bags that have been produced that says, I dissent. So she goes along with it. She's having fun.
Betsy West and Julie Cohen there speaking to Augustin Macellari, and RBG hits UK screens from the 4th of January. We do recommend you check it out. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
You are listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Marcus Hippi, and Tom Edwards. From a young age, Brazilian art historian and curator Pedro Correa do Lago has been collecting important handwritten documents from around the world. And today he's known for holding one of the world's largest private collections of autographed letters and documents.
Following an exhibition of his collection at the Morgan Library Museum in New York, publishers Taschen have created a book with the collector called The Magic of Handwriting, showcasing the vast range of artefacts that all have the personal touch, from a Michelangelo sketch to a 2006 thumbprint signature by physicist Stephen Hawking. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco recently spoke to Pedro about the book and the importance of handwriting in an ever more digital world.
Many items in the collection are extremely rare. I mean, only one or two examples have been offered in the last 50 years in the open market, you know. But, I mean, I always dreamt of a letter by Van Gogh, but I eventually got one that had not exactly, that had not been understood in a very precise way by most of its holders. Because actually, it was a sort of inventory of his room, you know, which is arguably the most famous room in Western painting. You know, it's in everybody's retina, I guess. I mean, you can probably remember the room, as most of us do, because it was painted several times by Van Gogh. But it didn't present itself exactly as an inventory of the items in the room. Its content was misunderstood by many people over the years. So I was very fortunate to have interpreted it. I mean, sometimes you have to read between the lines and understand the importance of the contents of an item through further research or just sometimes luck or intuition.
Pedro, where do you keep your incredible collection?
I keep it in my home in São Paulo, where I live. But I have to accommodate them in fireproof filing cabinets that weigh half a ton each. So I'm obliged to live in a house and keep them in the ground floor, because the accumulation of all these fireproof filing cabinets would probably make any apartment building crumble.
Well, I can imagine. But you also, you know, you're trying, you know, of course, now we have the book, The Magic of Handwriting, so people will be able to see what's on your collection. But also the Morgan Library and Museum, they've exhibited some of your work there as well, right?
Yes, they did. Between June and September 2018, the Morgan Library, which is a mythical place for me. I mean, I first crossed its threshold, I mean, when I was 17, I'm now 60. So it's a magical place for me. I mean, it's the magic of handwriting in a magical place. I mean, the name Magic of Handwriting is a quote from Stefan Zweig, who also had a very important collection of manuscripts in the 30s and the 40s. And in a letter to Rilke, he says that his manuscripts have made him discover the magic of handwriting.
Pedro, of course, you live in São Paulo, you are Brazilian. I was always very happy to see that you have some documents, including some documents from Antônio Carlos Jobim. Tell us a bit more. I'm a big fan and I was quite interested in this one.
Well, I mean, I was fortunate enough. I mean, it was a hard battle to win. But actually, Jobim's original manuscript of Chega de Saudade, which is the song that inaugurates Bossa Nova in Brazil, was included in a Sotheby's auction in London about 10 years ago, together with manuscripts by Schumann, Beethoven, Mozart, the usual sorts of manuscripts that Sotheby's sell. And I was quite proud as a Brazilian as well to see a major composer of my country included in that sale, especially such an important song. And I was able to buy it, and I exhibited it at the Morgan Library, together with another 140 items that are also present in this book published by Taschen that is now coming out.
And Pedro, how optimistic are you that, you know, the handwriting will remain, you know, being important, and that perhaps you'll be able to, you know, continue your collection for many, many years to go? Or do you think it is actually changing?
I have no illusions about people writing handwritten letters or messages for a long time anymore. Perhaps quick messages to send a present or something like that. England is still a country that cultivates handwritten letters. It's still unthinkable to send a condolence letter that would not be entirely handwritten. But it's changing. I mean, many people now send condolence messages by email or even WhatsApp. But, you know, it's undeniable that letters of present personalities will be much rarer than people from the past that had to write a note for many things that we solve now with quick messages on the internet. I'm still quite confident that the letters from the personalities of the past will remain in demand. I mean, it's a complicated market. I mean, it doesn't have that many players. But many people are very enthusiastic, and I very much hope that the exhibition that was seen by more than 70,000 people and the book that Fashion is due to publish also in another languages may help increasing the enthusiasm about this very, very exciting pursuit.
And Pedro, finally, I know it's going to be very hard, but if you could choose perhaps one or two documents that you think people should know that there is in the book. I mean, because if I ask what's your favorite, I mean, come on, that's a pretty hard question.
Look, I've tried to select for the exhibition for the book, first, mostly household names. I mean, people whom most people are familiar with. And, I mean, I did include 5 Brazilians. After all, we are Brazilians, both you and me, Fernando.
Of course. But,
and I'm a Brazilian collector, and I wanted, of course, my country to be well represented, not only by Jobim, but also by Niemeyer, by Machado de Assis, and, I mean, Santos Dumont and Villa-Lobos. But most of the people are names like Churchill, Gandhi, Darwin, Newton, Gauguin, or Bach, Beethoven. So these are people I would say most people are familiar with. I mean, I very much like most of the items, as you can imagine. I recently acquired Isaac Newton's own family tree drawn by himself, you know, or written by himself with his name at the end, which I think is a very significant item. The wonderful letters by Darwin, the letter by Gauguin, where he says he had to change his plans because he was due to spend a year in the south of France painting with another friend who was also a painter and went stark raving mad, and he had to fear for his own life for a month. So, of course, letters of Gauguin referring to the famous episode of Van Gogh are extremely rare. So, as I told you, what makes an autograph or an autograph item important is the content. You know, there may be other fun things about it. The content may be much simpler, like Sigmund Freud writing a note saying, 20 hours, 2,000 shillings, you know. I mean, 4 hours of analysis, which summarizes more or less psychoanalysis. So, you know, I mean, I think these items are quite exciting. There are all sorts, you know. I mean, the most recent one is a thumbprint signature by Stephen Hawking, who, of course, was unable to sign for most of his life because of ALS. So, you know, I mean, it's very varied. There are drawings, there are official documents, there are, you know, letters from Henry VIII to the King of France. There is a document signed by popes and a saint in 1153, which is the oldest. So it's a very, let's say, a selection that where I tried to attract the attention, because it was an exhibition, and the interest of the average reader, I mean, the average informed reader.
Pedro Correa de Lago there speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and The Magic of Handwriting is published by Tashian and it is out now. You are with The Monocle Weekly.
Well, there you have it, Marcus. Let's thank the people behind the glass. The programme was produced by Tom Hall and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin.
This has been the edition number 493 of The Monocle Weekly, and the programme will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Marcus Hippi.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.